thought leader and influencer. This is Luba Mayegiso and the Africa Report.
Luba Mayegiso, good morning. How are you?
Morning, Howard. I'm good. Thank you, sir.
Excellent. Well, I mean, you guys down in Cape Town only are having stage one load shedding while we're having stage two. And we're also about to get a heat wave that is going to make life just a little bit more complicated for us up here.
I can imagine. I didn't even see the stage one coming. You know, I saw notices on social media, but you often think that it's just a prank. So I actually ignored it until somebody confirmed it. Rather sad that we're back there. Yeah. But, you know, you guys suffer more than we do. So I think by now, Howard, you should be used to suffering.
Yeah.
In silence.
Okay, hold on, Luba. I'm prepared to suffer. I'm not doing it in silence. Mm.
I have no sympathy if that's what you're looking for, I'm afraid.
Oh, fine. Well, thanks a lot, Luba. But, you know what? We were sympathetic when you guys didn't have water, weren't we, Zanati?
We really were.
We were?
Mm-hmm.
You never sent a drop of water down. You just kept remarking, how could a world-class city be like this? And you laughed at our plight of us driving to taps holding buckets of water and taking 30-second showers.
Right. No, that is true. No. Anyway, all right. Luba, it is conflict resolution day. Here we are in conflict. Well, not really. But it's very, very interesting. And, of course, we've had the Nino case with deep apologies, but we're not really good at resolving conflict, I think, in South Africa. I think what we do best here is to kind of plaster the cracks, move on, and hope that it doesn't come back to bite us, which it invariably does at a later stage. What's your thoughts?
I think it's something that we do. You're absolutely correct. I think that there are many issues that drive it, and some, I think, are cultural, and some are based in faith. I've always said that it's remarkable that when something horrible happens, usually the victim or the victim's, family are the first to jump and say, oh, we forgive the person. And I'm saying, but the person hasn't even actually told you what they've done. So there's almost a need to be seen to be conciliatory and reach out to the other side and say, we forgive. And I think that often precludes the process from taking its true course and the person being put in a position, because I think forgiveness is good, but forgiveness must come after the person has been fairly contrite, really admitted to what they've done, and they show remorse. Now, I've always said that when I look at criminal cases, if there's one person you can always bet to stand with you through thick and thin, it's always your mother. You know, you can have a person who kills 100 people, but there'll be a mother who'll be there who'll be saying, not my son. This is not my son. You know, you guys are confused. So sometimes I think parents, and in this case grandparents, are very quick to jump in defense of a loved one, of a child or a grandchild. And that does make things very complicated, because I think there is anger around this issue. And to come out and say, he's a sweet boy, you know, this is not him. We sometimes forget that people have very complex personalities where to you they can be absolutely sweet and wonderful. But in a different context, people can behave very differently. It's the same person. It might be hard to accept, but it's the same person. But I think in general, we need to forgive, but first allow a process to take through and be convinced. It's very difficult to be convinced, but be convinced that the person is sincere and is showing a contrite heart, that they're remorseful.
So it's interesting. I want to bring David in on this conversation. David, I have no doubt that he's remorseful. And I have no doubt that he feels terrible about what he's done. But I don't know whether that's because of the shame of it, whether it's... And my other concern is, do we actually ever really know people? Do we know ourselves? I don't think we do. I don't think, you know, in the cold light of day, most of us will say, I would never do A, B, C, or D. But studies show that people, even if they would have thought that they wouldn't have done something, given the right amount of alcohol or drugs or sexual excitement, will do dangerous things.
Well, when your inhibitions are down, clearly, you know, we can do things that we don't normally do. But I think for me, really, you know, it's interesting, because I think, you know, when people are caught, you know, there's often remorse. But I think the line really is between real remorse, proper remorse, and pathological remorse is, are you remorseful for being caught? Are you upset for being caught, rather than being truly remorseful? And I think there's an amazing example recently with in America. I don't know if you saw, Luba, Amber Geiger. She was a Dallas police officer who mistakenly walked into the wrong apartment, and she thought that there was a gentleman in her apartment, and she shot this guy dead. And she was actually put on trial and sentenced to 10 years in jail. But so remarkably, her brother, who wanted to be involved in the court proceedings, actually got on the stand and, after she was sentenced, wanted to hug her and say to her, I forgive you. And I think for me, what Luba's saying is, once a process has taken its course, once you can evaluate, and I think for me, people could, and the family could really see that,
there
was genuine remorse. There was going to be a consequence. Mm. That there's so much more room then to forgive.
But it's also quite different there, where somebody made a terrible, terrible mistake. Mm. It's not a deliberate, willful act of rape.
Absolutely.
You know, it's very different. Sorry, Luba.
where I struggle often with this is that I can understand, you saying, you know, how is that a violent person? But should a situation arise where, say, for argument's sakes, somebody said something to a family member, your wife or your daughter, it would be very easy to instinctively strike out in defense without thinking. Where I may say, Howard or Luba are not generally violent or aggressive people, but you never know what could happen if you pushed. Now, that's something else. But no amount of alcohol, I believe, you know, I could sit and drink, let's say, 4 bottles of the finest single malt with you. But in my,
yeah, it's in not going to turn you into a rapist. Yeah.
I would never rape a person, 100%. Right? So no matter how much alcohol we sit and drink, we can drink until we're paralytic, right? But raping a person is always going to be wrong, because no matter how drunk I am, whatever powers of reasoning I have will always still kick in and say, this is wrong. So that's where I have a problem, that alcohol can diminish, let's say, your powers of reasoning, but it can't take them out the window completely, where you're behaving, you know, almost like, let's say, something with no powers of reasoning. I don't want to say an animal, you know, but there are instances where I'm saying this to you truthfully, there are instances where you could commit an offense that would be criminal in defense of a person. You know, you could drive at 200 k's an hour if someone's having a heart attack to get them to hospital deliberately or unknowingly. If you're walking down the street, let's say with your grand, with your mom, and some guy grabbed the handbag or smacked her, instinctively you would punch the person. Now, that act might be wrongful, but it would always be in defense. So for me, I think what would suspend my powers of reasoning is some, you know, major crime being committed or something hectic wrong.
So that's your trigger.
Yeah.
But
my trigger.
In this type of a situation, there is no trigger. Mm-hmm. I mean, there must be, but it's not one that is acceptable. I think the question is, do we, you know, we meant to allow people, you know, the Jewish concept of teshuvah, of repentance. We meant to be able to repent and genuinely start the, you know, clean the slate. But it's a very, very difficult situation. You know, are people ever really, you know, how do we know if people are legitimate in their repentance, I guess?
I think it's always important to, you know, being a psychologist, to look at their past. And often when you look at people's past, and again, I don't know this particular gentleman's past and his experiences, but invariably when someone commits a crime like this, there is something traumatic or unbelievably difficult in their past that they've experienced. But as Luba says, does that give one an excuse? Is it a good enough excuse to say, well, you know, that's the reason I did it, so I need some kind of leniency? And I think that's where the difficulty starts to come into, you know, into play, is, you know, again, is there genuine remorse, number one? Is this person really remorseful? Mm-hmm. And will they not do this again? And were there any circumstances that, you know, led to this person acting in this way? But again, that's the question. And the big question is, How much do we take that into consideration when looking at punishment?
Mm, mm.
And that's very tricky.
Let's spin this thing in a crazy way. Can I take my growing up during apartheid and pain as an excuse to strike at white people? I think I can't. You know, as much as that pain may be embedded there, we also have a responsibility in society to be able to deal with whatever trauma we have. And I do admit that we don't often get a chance to vent and deal with the issues. But it's almost an open checkbook, a very blank license to say to people, you know, your trauma should be able to allow you to do that. I mean, David's not saying that, but I think often in this country we tend to look at that. And if you look at national reconciliation, to me, that's a perfect example of we went from apartheid to let's kiss it, make up a rainbow nation. And I mean, largely driven by our, you know, President Mandela and the Archbishop Tutu and co. So it was wonderful to see, but it was a rushed job that left us where we are because we never really got to deal with the issues. We kind of said, we're here, we're legislating that we're there. And overnight we got there. And I think it's part of the South African mentality. I know, for instance, when I look at the, even in the African context, I mean, some of the issues we covered last time, conflict resolution, often in the African context, is never really an interrogation of what happened and what caused that behavior. There's a genuine need to reconcile. So if you take a marriage, for instance, and the poor wife suffers abuse, physical or whatever issue, she runs home to her parents, they run to the in-laws, the meeting is called. Usually the woman will say, the mum-in-law will say, my child, just sit tight. I've been through this, whether it's infidelity or whatever. You know what? I've had this with my own husband. So it's not a case of what happened, how can we resolve. The victim is almost being pleaded with to say, these things happen. Just you know, put up with it. And the guy on the other side, the inquiry is never, how could you do this? It's almost, how could you get caught? You must be more discreet. So you find that even culturally, we're very quick to try and just move on and not deal with the issue. And I think in many ways it leaves us with the open wound. You know, obviously you're putting a plaster, as you're saying, on an open wound, and the wound is festering underneath. And getting all horrible. But you need to allow the wound, you know, the process to take its course. So nationally, we haven't done that. And if we can't do it nationally, we're going to struggle to do it in individual cases. And what I'm starting to see on social media, which Lindy sent me earlier, it starts to take racial overtones because that's another wound that's not quite healed. So when we look at this case, then people are saying, yeah, but if this guy was black, people calling for the black, for the death sentence. And again, that's, you know, that other lack of healing that's manifesting in how we view everything, because no matter what crime we look at, whether it was an Oscar or whatever, we put on a racial lens and we look at issues in that way.
Yeah, interesting. One of our listeners, Mim, says the death penalty for rape ASAP. End of stories. And Zanati, your thoughts on this?
If he is truly remorseful, he shouldn't even try. He shouldn't even be trying to mitigate the sentence. He should literally be ready to accept any punishment if he's ready. I'm so tired of seeing this guy saying, I'm sorry, and, you know, saying that other prisoners are looking down on him. It's not about him.
Other prisoners are looking down on him?
Yeah, he's literally said in an article on EWN that even other prisoners are looking down on him. And I'm like, you don't
need... All right, well,
say sorry once and that's
it. Yeah.
Like, there's no need for you to convince us that you are sorry. It's about the victim. Why is it all about him and how he was? His grandmother raised him in a good way. He's still a good boy. Why? I don't.
Well, it's always the question as to, and I don't know the answer to this. I always struggle with it. Is when do good people's actions that are bad actions actually make them bad people? At what point, you know, do we say, okay, you know what, he's a good guy, or she's a good girl, a good woman, and but unfortunately did something wrong? You know, we do that with our friends. We accept that our friends might be good people, but people make mistakes, people do the wrong things, they make the wrong choices. But when do those choices actually make them bad people?
I think people.
Howard, can I just sidestep that? Sorry, David.
No, that's it.
And just say, just remember, mitigation is part of a legal process. So I'm not in his defense, but I'm simply saying,
yeah,
in the trial and sentencing procedure, you know, the judge will say, you know, do you have anything to say in mitigation? Now, either the guy will say, oh, no, nothing. But generally, whether it's a disciplinary matter or whatever, there is an opportunity afforded for a person to put up whatever statements or anything that they think will mitigate their sentence. So I think that's a process that's there. We may not like it, but we may also need to focus and say, the purpose of the whole criminal justice system, is it punitive, or do we believe a person can be rehabilitated? Because this discussion, I can assure you, will move on, because once the sentence is passed, people will then take sides, too lenient, too harsh. And I think, you know, so it's an ongoing discussion, not just the crime itself, but the actual sentence. You know, do we believe it is fair? Do we believe that people can be rehabilitated? I mean, David can speak to that better than any of us can, because I think the criminal justice system always wants to leave room and say, we believe an offender can be rehabilitated. Therefore, we're not just hitting them, you know, for a six. We have to make leeway that the person will be contrite. So that's the next discussion. So I think maybe David can help us there and say, I mean, based on what he knows, the prevalence of people being genuinely remorseful and changing during the sentencing, serving up their sentence, or do people just stay where they are or get worse?
Luba, I think in my experience, there are a group of people who cannot be rehabilitated, that they think in a certain way, they see the world in a certain way, and are going to be repeat offenders. So I think it's naive, I think, for authorities to say in a blanket statement that everyone can be, you know, rehabilitated. But certainly Howard's question around, you know, do good people make mistakes? Absolutely. But still, there needs to be a consequence. And when we think about it, if we bring it down to our children,
for the victim's sake.
Absolutely. If we think of, you know, if bring it down to something a little bit more simple, when you think about it, you know, if your child, and I always, you know, we always had this in a child, our child does something wrong. Do we say they didn't mean to do it, but, you know, they were playing cricket outside and they broke a window. They didn't mean to do it. Does that make them a bad child? Maybe not, but does there need to be a consequence? Absolutely. And I think for me, that's the point, is that people need to take responsibility, as Anati said, for what they've done. And depending on the degree of that transgression, you know, the penalty needs to be put in place. So I think for me, it is about saying, absolutely, let's look at case-by-case situations and understand what the person has done. Look at the history of the person, as in, have they done this before? Evaluate. Let the professionals evaluate whether this person can be rehabilitated or not. But definitely, there needs to be a consequence, because even when good people do something that's not not good, for want of a better word, you know, the only way you learn as a human being is by there being some kind of consequence, which then often leads to remorse.
Yeah, absolutely. Unfortunately, we do have to leave it there. It is 8:54. Luba Mayegiso, so thank you as always. David Abramson, fascinating conversation. I'd love your thoughts, David, before you go. Yossi says, agreed with David, with Professor Google available for our kids on the smartphone 24/7, consent-based should be replaced with skills. Content-based should be replaced with skills and opinion-based learning. For example, instead of our kids having to chase the distinctions by regurgitating simple facts, give them the facts and let them form an opinion on it. Also empower them with enhancement mechanisms to deal with real life issues such as conflict, cyberbullying, etc.
Couldn't have said it any better. That's absolutely so important. And another thing is, you know, I know we're running out of time today, but interestingly enough, also to start discerning what information is correct and what should be taken seriously and absorbed and requoted.
And how to challenge. I think challenging pieces, challenging articles that are written and saying, well, how do we get to the – what is true here? What is not? Are we seeing bias? Let them try and pick apart things and become critical thinkers rather than just accepting that which we read.
And when I think about it, you know, the word that comes to mind is, you know, a little bit of chutzpah. You know, you need to have a little bit of chutzpah in your kids to, and obviously there's a fine line between chutzpah and behaving inappropriately.
Absolutely.
But that chutzpah, maybe that confidence, that self-esteem to say, hang on, let me interrogate this. Is this, you know, I am entitled to ask questions. I do have an opinion. And if it's wrong, it's wrong. But at least I've engaged.
Absolutely right. There we leave it. Time is 8:56. David Abramson, thank you as always.